Tonight we come to our third part of our study in church history that has been focusing upon Baptist beginnings as we are looking at the early stages of the Baptist in England. And we will also look at the beginning of the Baptist in America tonight as well. So this is part three of our look at Baptist beginnings. We have looked at the two groups, main groups that were in England, the General Baptist and the Particular Baptist. We looked last week at John Bunyan, one of the important early Baptists in England. And this evening we want to pick up with another important man in the development of English Baptists, especially the Particular Baptist, and that is Benjamin Keach. Benjamin Keach is believed by many Baptist historians to be the greatest and most important Baptist theologian of the late 17th century. He is, for Baptists, the equivalent of two of his contemporaries, Richard Baxter, who was a Presbyterian in England, and John Owen, who was a Congregationalist. Just as important as Baxter is to the Presbyterians during this time, and Owen was to the Congregationalists at that time, so was Keach to Baptists in England. Indeed, he towers above many of his Baptist contemporaries. His writings are only in the same league as Bunyan during this time period. But he was a prolific author. Many of his sermons were published in books during these days. He was a powerful preacher, very strong doctrinally, and also very strong evangelistic in his preaching as well. He also would become very important towards the end of his ministry for two big reasons. Number one, he was very instrumental in the gathering of the assembly in 1689 in the publication of the London Confession that year, and also because he was an early advocate of singing, besides the Psalms, hymns, congregational hymn singing. And so some of the first ever hymnals will be published during his days because of his advocacy. So Benjamin Keach had a profound impact not only upon Baptists but Protestants in general in England and in our day today because of what he championed. Keach is also interesting because he goes from being, the beginning of his life and his ministry, a General Baptist and moving into the Particular Baptist and, of course, becoming a leader in the Particular Baptist movement. He was born in the year 1640. He was raised as an Anglican, as many were during this time period. But at the age of 15, he was converted and joined with a General Baptist congregation. He began preaching at the age of 18. So he was a young man when he began in ministry. It would not be long, though, when he was 24 years old in the year 1664, when he would find himself in trouble with the Church of England and the English government. In fact, he was arrested on charge of being seditious, heretical, and a schismatical, or a person that was trying to stir up schisms or divisions among the people. So he was arrested on those charges. What was his crime? Well, he had written a primer. It was what we would call similar to a catechism, but it was not really primarily aimed at doctrine, this first document that he ever wrote. It was a primer instead for children that contained lessons for reading, punctuation, and simple basic arithmetic. But he was reported to the authorities by the local Anglican rector, who stated that this primer was, quote, seditious. And so one reason why many believe it was labeled that way was because Keach did make a reference to believers' baptism in the primer. And so that was the means for arresting Benjamin Keach. And so Benjamin Keach was found guilty. He was forced to pay a fine of £20, and he was to remain in prison for 2 weeks. He also was forced to have to stand for two periods a day of 2 hours in the pillory. And there is the picture, an artistic rendition, and this would be, of course, Benjamin Keach. And as you can see, this device, man, the prisoner's head, as well as his two hands, were placed inside these holes. He was secured. This was put in the public square, in the village square, the town square, depending on how large of a community it was. And so this was a way of public shaming and public humiliation, because you can imagine if you are in that type of predicament and you're here in the middle so everyone can see you, of course you can imagine people came by, they had comments they would make, they might even throw something at you. And so it was not necessarily a very pleasant ordeal. But Benjamin Keach seized these two-hour periods to preach and to defend his beliefs. And it is said on one occasion that an Anglican clergyman came by, and as Keach was preaching in this position, the Anglican clergyman reprimanded him and rebuked him, telling him to be silent because he was a publisher and a writer of errors. Keach then asked the clergyman to point out the errors from the scriptures. And the clergyman, before he could speak, a crowd rounded him up. The reason, the clergyman, they perceived, was to be drunk. So Keach continued to preach. The authorities came threatening him, told him to be silent, and they eventually told him, if you will not be silent, we will gag you. Keach then made one more statement, and then he was silent. He quoted Matthew 5 and verse 10, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then he was silent. And so here in the early days of the life and ministry of Benjamin Keach, even something that was very basic and very, very simple, though was a threat because it threatened the conformity that the hierarchical Church of England demanded among the citizens. Especially, remember, in 1664, we were just a few years after the reign of Cromwell, the rise of the Puritans, and now the monarchy has retaken hold of England. And so they were going to make sure that everybody towed the line. And so Benjamin Keach, as a young man, young minister, definitely felt persecution for his stances. But it did not stop him at all. Instead, he becomes a great witness of the faith in the years that follow. And so what's important then is there's a big change in Benjamin Keach's life. In the year 1668, so about 4 years after those events, he arrives in London, where he joined a General Baptist group that was meeting at Southwark. And he soon became an elder in this church. But while he was there in London, Keach met and became acquaintance at first, but then very close friends with two men. Now, the first gentleman's name, I'm hoping that I'm pronouncing correctly, and it's the best of my ability that I believe so, Hansard Knollys and William Kiffin. These two individuals were two of the most prominent particular Baptists in London. And so, as you can imagine, they quickly took Keach under their wings and began to meet with him and study with him and discuss doctrine and theology. They're coming from a more Calvinistic viewpoint. He's coming from an Arminian viewpoint. But the reason that we call these men so important was William Kiffin, one of these two individuals, is the only man who signed both copies of the London Confession. He signed it in 1644 and he signed it in 1689, the only gentleman who did that. And so no doubt through their friendship, their time together of discussing and studying the Word, Benjamin Keach would come from Arminianism and become a Calvinist. And so he would leave the General Baptist behind and he would join the particular Baptist. Now, during the 17th and 18th centuries in England, it was not strange at all for someone to move from the general to the particular Baptist camp. It was rare and very rarely ever occurred where somebody left the particular Baptist and joined the general Baptist. Well, in 1668, in that same year, after leaving the general Baptist group, Keach, along with some others, formed a work in what was known is called Horse Lie Down. Now, that's not all hyphenated there. That's the actual word, how you pronounce it. It's one word. But why is that important? Because the particular Baptist congregation that started there in Horse Lie Down would eventually become the New Park Street Chapel, which became the Metropolitan Tabernacle that Charles Spurgeon pastored. And the Metropolitan Tabernacle still serves as a congregation today. So here, we'll talk about this chart in just a few moments. But here you see a church that began in this mid-17th century. And Benjamin Keach had a part in the planting, really, in the beginning of that church. Still bears a gospel witness in London and beyond to this day. Keach, as you can see up here, served as a pastor there from 1668 to 1704. In his time in his pulpit ministry and as a pastor, he became known for his very strong defense of biblical Calvinism. Now, why is that important? Because by the days of Keach, and especially as you're approaching the year 1700, the Puritan theology, Puritanism, was beginning to be viewed as, quote-unquote, old-fashioned, too harsh. And men like Richard Baxter, for example, had begun to try to modify it to what would be more acceptable to the congregations and to the masses in England. But Keach was vigorous in his defense of that which the Puritans had proclaimed. He also was a strong defender of the Reformed belief, and we know as the biblical belief of justification by faith alone. During this time as well, Benjamin Keach would become famous for being very much a part of the movement, first in 1677, and then in 1689, of redrafting and republishing a new confession of faith that we know as the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith. He was very much a main individual in that assembly that met in London in 1689. Of course, from that, he would produce what we know as the Baptist Catechism in the 1690s that is still used to this day. And he would become very much, towards the end of his ministry, very much a part of a controversy that began. In fact, in 1689, you had the particular Baptists there in the British Isles coming together and being united. And there was very much, shall we say, a great encouragement among them that they had come together as a group of over 100 churches. They had come together and agreed to this confession of faith, and it would be kind of a new era of unity as they went forward. Well, for some reason, Baptists just have a hard time staying united. And it would not be long where there would come division. And believe it or not, it might be hard for us to comprehend. The division came over hymn singing and congregational singing. Most of the churches before that time would only sing the Psalter, the Psalms. But in 1673, Keach began to broaden out of that and to encourage full congregational singing. And as you can imagine, that rocked the boat. And Keach began to write tracts and pamphlets explaining his stance. He defended his practice based upon the Bible. He said Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16, James 5:13 were all biblical passages where there is a command for believers to sing. He also went to the example of the angelic host praising God. But, and I know it's hard because this seems very simple to us, but this was such a divisive topic that his two close friends, Kiffin and Knollys, they divided. They were on one was on one side and one was on the other side. That's how much this caused division during this time. And of course, Keach had his opponents who would write pamphlets and tracts as well to present, saying that, you know, we don't find any example of the Bible of what you want, Benjamin Keach. And so it caused much of a distress during the late 1600s and early 1700s. Benjamin Keach would die in the year 1704, having served 36 years as pastor. And with his death closed a very important chapter in the early days of the English Particular Baptist, with Bunyan's death in 1688 and Keach's death in 1704. But Benjamin Keach and his example and his faithfulness began very much in London, specifically in this congregation, a pattern of strong biblical pastors and expositors. For example, look at these men here. Keach served there 36 years. Later would come John Gill. John Gill served there for 51 years. And of course was a prolific author of commentaries on the books of the Bible, as well as systematic and pastoral theology. Then Gill's successor, John Rippon, who you might recognize, we sing some hymns that he wrote, he served for 63 years. So think about just two pastors here, just two men, served for a total, I'm going to get in trouble doing math here, 114 years. So think about that, just two pastors in a 114-year period. And then, of course, Charles Spurgeon comes later in 1854 to 92. He serves 38 years. And the church remained strong for a good period of time after Spurgeon passed. But in the middle of the 20th century, especially in the 1950s and 60s, the Metropolitan Tabernacle was basically down to a dozen people. And a building that could hold 1,000 by this time. And the reason was, as the church had begun to be affected by the Protestant liberalism of the day that Spurgeon had fought so hard. Well, then Dr. Peter Masters came along in 1970 and has been there ever since. And the church is once again a thriving congregation of nearly 1,000 members today. But when you look at a church, and it's not always been easy for them, but when you think of that long of a witness, what stands out? They had men who stayed there and poured their lives there for years. And I think that is very indicative of a strong church, especially when you think of one that has been there for centuries, of having strong, faithful, steadfast pastoral leadership. And of course, all of those men were supported by other elders and deacons who served there as well. And so there we see in the 17th century the shaping of Baptists in England, the general Baptist and the particular Baptist, having more of the influence for most of that century. Well, what's happening, as they say, across the pond in the New England colonies? What about Baptists in America? What is the story there? Well, to understand the early American Baptists, we need to remember that the Puritans, of course, a group, had set sail and landed at Plymouth Rock. And remember, they had fled persecution at the hands of the Anglican Church. But there is something important to remember. They did not come to set up a place where anybody could worship however they wanted to. Okay? They came to set up a society based upon Puritan beliefs. And they wanted to have a New Jerusalem. Not that they were crazy like the Anabaptists we had studied about, the one particular sect that went, you know, crazy. But they were looking for a place where they could fully live out their beliefs religiously and from a civil standpoint. So here's the key. They did not come to establish separation of church and state here. They were still in the belief of a state church and that atmosphere. And so that's going to cause problems. Because remember, back in England, The Puritans and the Puritans slash congregationalists slash separatists slash independents were not the only ones who were experiencing this persecution. So were the Baptists as well. And the Baptists and the Congregationalists were allies in England. They worked together. Yes, they had differences on church structure and baptism, but they did have much in common. John Bunyan held John Owen in high esteem, as did Owen held Bunyan in high esteem. We talked about that last week, as well as when John Bunyan wrote his allegory, The Holy War. One of the captains in that book is modeled after John Owen, who, of course, Owen was one of the most preeminent theologians of the day. But as Puritans came, and in 1630, when the Massachusetts Bay Colony was established under their governor, John Winthrop, there was not going to be any toleration for anyone who did not adhere to Congregationalist slash Puritan way of worship and life. And so there were early Baptists and some Quakers who came from England who wanted to come to the New World. They believed it would be better and more peaceable for them, but they would soon become targets of persecution. And so what's going to happen with these early Baptists? Well, out of that persecution would arise a man who, on one hand, is very pivotal in Baptist history and the shaping of it. And on the other hand, he's somewhat a controversial figure, because even though we give him some credit for the beginning of Baptist life in America, as you will see, he did not remain a Baptist for very long at all. And so it's kind of a very weird story in a sense. But Roger Williams was born in London in either 1603 or 1604. Historians are not exactly sure. He was a student at Cambridge. He was studying to be an Anglican priest. And during his studies there, he became a Puritan. But not only would he be a Puritan, but he would also become a separatist. Now, before he left England, he was just a Puritan in the sense that he believed that the Church of England could be purified and reformed. And so in the year 1630, Roger Williams, along with his wife, set sail for the Massachusetts colony. And they arrived in 1631. But during that voyage, Williams, after studying the New Testament, became so convicted that he believed that the Puritans slash Congregationalists had not went far enough. And so he, in a sense, became a separatist, believing that the Puritans needed to separate fully from the Anglican Church, have no part with them at all, detach themselves from the state church. Now, when Williams arrived, people here in the Massachusetts Bay Colony had heard of him, knew he was coming, knew he was a minister. And so he was very soon invited to come and preach and lead worship in the church. But he refused to. When he said and came and saw that the church was not, quote, unseparated, he said, I cannot lead worship and be a part of this congregation. He believed that when you gathered for worship, you did not need to have unregenerate or non-believers there. It wasn't just that they shouldn't participate in the Lord's Supper. He didn't believe they needed to be there for worship, period. His reasoning was, he said, that it pollutes and defiles the worship service. Now, you have to understand that at that time, you were required to go. That was the law of the colony. You had to go attend services on the Sabbath. And so his viewpoint was, on one hand, no, that defiles it. On the other hand, it should be voluntary to go to worship, not mandated. He also did not believe that the civil magistrate had any right or authority to enforce any type of penalty or punishment upon anyone who broke one of the first four of the Ten Commandments or any type of religious infraction. It was not the civil government's duty. So, what's going to happen? Well, obviously, Roger Williams' views and the views of John Winthrop and the Massachusetts Bay Colony leadership and the Congregationalist Church are going to collide. And I think it's pretty easy to summarize who's going to win this argument. But here's the problem. It was not just on these issues that Roger Williams caused problems. It was also in the relationship with the Native Americans. As you can see by the quote, Williams was very much mad at the leadership of the colony and how he believed they had just come and robbed the Native Americans of their land without giving any kind of recompense or payment to them. And so now he's not only causing issues with the religious side and the government side, but now he's aiming for pocketbooks as well. And so Roger Williams is a threat. He's a threat. And the leadership, beginning with John Winthrop and others, said, "We cannot let this man stay here." And so, in October 1635, they ordered him to be banished from the colony, and they were going to send him back to England. His views on the complete separation of church and state, his views on no role for the magistrates when it came to religious life, and his views of how the Native Americans had been treated, and Williams was also beginning to minister to the Native Americans as well, were all viewed as threats that could undermine the Massachusetts government. And remember, now, I know, from my standpoint, I would disagree with how the Puritans had set up their government. But this is also a time where we want to think about where they were historically. And in their mindset, if you're beginning a colony and new settlement, you got to have what? Their perspective, you had to have conformity and order if it was going to survive. If you did not have that, if you had just a bunch of people with all kinds of opinions and one person doing this and one person doing that, and now you've got battles on different sides of an ideological view and all that, it was going to cause chaos, and they would not prosper, and they would not survive. So I'm not saying they were totally right in what they were doing, but I do want us to see from their standpoint why they believed the way. Much of their view was that this was a matter of survival. And, of course, no doubt there was some greed as well involved with land and all those types of things. That had a part, too. But most of it, they were wanting to survive as a new settlement, a new colony. So, Roger Williams was going to be sent back. But before they could deport him, and due to his friendship with the Native Americans, they took care of him for 3 months. And they would help him, and he would actually buy land from the Native Americans. And he and his wife, along with some friends, would settle what we know today as Providence, Rhode Island. And so in the summer of 1636, Williams and his group would found the settlement, and they called it Providence in the modern state of Rhode Island. Roger Williams had a vision, and that was that this would be a colony, and it would be a colony that practiced religious liberty for all. And so in 1644, Williams made his way back to England, and of course this was a very pivotal time in English history. This was the middle of the English Civil War. He received a charter for this new colony, which would become Rhode Island. He would also publish his famous work, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution for Cause of Conscience. Williams would argue that the Bible promoted and allowed religious liberty and freedom of conscience when it came to worship and faith. He would serve as governor of the Rhode Island colony for a time, and it became a place of refuge, not only for Baptists, but for Jews, for Quakers, as well as any other non-congregationalist Protestant that might be in New England. Now, when we think about Roger Williams and the founding of Providence in Rhode Island, we also have to remember as well the First Baptist Church in America. In the year 1638 or 1639, again it's debated, the First Baptist Church in America was organized there in Providence. Now, you might think that with Roger Williams and all of his controversies, that his views on baptism would have been the main reason the Congregationalists wanted him out. And that was not really, though, the main reason. It had a part, but it was really his views on the separation of church and state and his views about relationships with the Native Americans that caused a lot of issues. Williams, it is believed, did have some connections with some of the English particular Baptists. And John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, did label Williams as, quote, of the Anabaptist. We're also, though, going to listen to the story of Roger Williams, and we're going to be reminded of a man's story we've already heard. That is Mr. John Smythe, because we're going to have the same issue happen again. Of course, as they are coming to their beliefs about believers' baptism, well, all these individuals have been sprinkled as Anglicans or Congregationalists, as Puritans. And so to come to his view that baptism was only for believers, Williams was influenced by a man named Ezekiel Holliman. Now, there's not much known about this individual except that he was a part of this first group there in Providence. And obviously, he had a very much a conviction about baptism. And so, again, 1638 or 39, it depends upon the date that's debated, Holliman baptized Williams first. And then Williams baptized Holliman and the rest, about 10 or so men and women. And so they formed the First Baptist Church. Roger Williams can be called the first Baptist in America, and he was the first Baptist in Rhode Island. He was also the first ex-Baptist in Rhode Island as well. Because after only a period of about 3 or 4 months, he left it. He left the Baptist Church. And he called into question the legitimacy of his baptism. Very similar to the problem John Smythe had at the beginning of the General Baptist. Now, Williams is a little bit different than Smythe on what his issue was. Williams believed that the church had lost the ordinances or the sacraments. Believed they had been polluted and were lost after the 4th century, when Constantine embraced Christianity. And so he believed that Rome had so corrupted the ordinances that they could not be real. They weren't true. And they would only be genuine or real when a new apostle came on the scene to reinstate these matters. So it's actually a contradiction in a way with Roger Williams. On one hand, he believed deeply. There is no denying. He believed deeply in the separation of church and state. But on the other hand, he had a deep belief in a visible apostolic succession that is at the heart of the papacy, as well as has a very strong core in the Anglican church. And so even though he said we need to be totally separated from it, they need to be separated, he still held to a big part of what drove the state church, and that was apostolic succession. And so Williams would become what were known as seekers. He was a seeker, meaning he was seeking and waiting for this new apostle to come and correct the wrongs that had been done in the church. And as you might guess, that apostle never came in his lifetime. And so he lived out the remainder of his days. Now, he lived to be an old man for that time period. He lived until 1683. Most all of his contemporaries passed on, and he was still around. He did write and say that he believed that the Baptists were the closest to the right thing, but he still didn't recognize that there was any legitimate church until this new apostle came. So Roger Williams is an interesting character. He would have a strong and close friendship with Oliver Cromwell. He would return to England in the 1650s and meet with Cromwell, and they exchanged their agreement on freedom of religion. Cromwell agreed with Williams, and so we were thankful for his witness on that. We're thankful for the part. In fact, Roger Williams is one of the statues at the Protestant Reformation Wall in Europe. I don't know why he's included in that, to be honest, among some of the other gentlemen up there, but he is. But he's an interesting character. Now, the church there in Providence would split in a few short decades. Williams, of course, had come as more Calvinistic, but during his time, and then briefly, he was there very briefly and then left, and the church split over the doctrines of grace and the rise of Arminianism. And it would become primarily an Arminian church all the way until the late 1770s, when it would revert to Calvinism again. But sadly, and that's a picture of the church today, the First Baptist Church of Providence is not an Orthodox church anymore. Today, we would consider it a classical, liberal Protestant church that does not hold to the inerrancy of scriptures, and that would just be the starting point of a lot of doctrinal issues that exist there. And so it is a sad example of a church that's hundreds of years old, but today where it is, nowhere resembles the foundation and the principles that the church began upon. Well, it was not only Roger Williams that was important during these days for Baptists in America, but there was also John Clark and the Second Baptist Church that was planted in Rhode Island, and that was in Newport. Now, while the church in Providence dealt with internal issues, it would be this second church that really was a church that had a heart for seeing the Baptist faith and the Baptist cause spread. And so, the church in Newport would be the moving force behind Baptist expansion in New England. John Clark, who you can see there, was trained to be a physician in Holland before arriving in Boston in 1637. Conflict would lead Clark to move to Rhode Island, where he had become convinced of Baptist beliefs, and he would be a part of founding the Baptist Church in Newport. He would serve there for over 30 years. The church was organized in the year 1644. Clark would be aided by a man named Mark Lucar, who came from London. He was a particular Baptist, and he came and served as a co-elder. And it was Lucar, and of course, just think about these dates, mid-1640s. He's coming from London. He's a particular Baptist. And remember that in the late 1630s, we noted that the particular Baptists were the first Baptists to say, not only is it believer's baptism, but it is baptism by immersion. So Lucar came and helped Clark and those in Newport come to understand that the Bible taught not only believer's baptism, but that it was by immersion only. And so it's very interesting that Lucar and Clark, there in Newport, corresponded frequently with their brothers in England. And it demonstrates that in these early days, there was a very strong bond that existed between the English and the American particular Baptist. These two men would be joined by another elder, Obadiah Holmes, and they would see the Baptist cause grow. In fact, in 1652, the first known African-American Baptist in America joined the church. The only record we have is his name was Jack. It's all that was listed in the records. But this kind of shows to you what their mindset was, that they wanted to see the faith grow. Well, as you can imagine, their vision was, of course, not shared by everyone in New England. And these men, these three men, would become embroiled in a controversy. Because in the year 1651, there was a man named William Widder in Salem, Massachusetts, who was excommunicated by the Congregationalist Church. Widder was baptized as an adult, so that was his first error in their viewpoint. But he went a step further. He began to charge that infant baptism was sinful and, quote, a badge of the whore. Now, we can disagree with those on baptism, but William Widder was an example of someone who could go from disagreement to going too far. And so, 2 years after that incident, he declared that those who baptized children worshipped the devil. So he was again asked to recant and publicly repent. He refused. He was an elderly man. And so they had pity and they didn't, shall we say, put him in the public square and flog him and make him an example. Well, he asked for some people to come visit him. And that would be our friends from Newport, Clark, Holmes, and another member of that church, John Crandall. And so on July the 20th, 1651, they held a service in Widder's home. Now you might say, well, that's a wonderful thing. Well, July 20th was a Sunday. And there in Massachusetts, we're not in Rhode Island now, we're in Massachusetts, there was no such thing as holding any worship service on the Lord's Day except at the Congregationalist Church. And to do so, to hold a private service, was a crime. Well, the local leadership was informed of this on that Lord's Day. But they waited until Tuesday to act. And on Tuesday, the men from Rhode Island, so not Widder, but the men from Rhode Island, were arrested and imprisoned. Their crime, for holding a private meeting on the Lord's Day, and seeking to undermine infant baptism. They were found guilty, obviously, and they were ordered to pay a fine. Obadiah Holmes was ordered to pay £30, Clark £20, Crandall £5. If they refused to pay, they would be publicly whipped in the square. Well, all three of these men opposed paying the fine, but Clark was bailed by friends of his, and Crandall changed his mind and decided he would pay. And they went back to Rhode Island. But Obadiah Holmes refused to pay himself, and he refused to have any of his friends pay. He said he would take the lashings. And so he would be taken, and there is a artistic sketch work of what took place. And he would receive 30 lashes for his crime. Obadiah Holmes would write to some of those particular Baptist brethren back in England, and he said that during that time the presence of God spiritually was so real that he said it felt as if he was being whipped, quote, with roses. Now, what does that all mean by that? I don't know. We'll have to ask him one day. But nevertheless, this instance and his, what they would call defiance, and we would say faithfulness, would become the catalyst that over the next decades forced the Massachusetts Bay Colony to have to be more tolerant. Now, it didn't happen overnight. But after this took place, there was a man named Henry Dunster who declared his rejection of paedo baptism, of infant baptism, saying he had searched and searched and searched the New Testament, and he could not find it. Now, we might say, well, big deal, who's Henry Dunster? Well, he was the first president of Harvard College. And so this was not just some regular Joe down the road here. This was a man who had influence and sway. And so the leadership of the colony met with him privately, urging him, counseling him to come back, you know, to the ways of the Congregationalists, to forsake these Baptist views. But he refused and said, I cannot find it in the Scripture. And so Dunster would step down from his position. But the Massachusetts government did not charge him or did not put him on trial or publicly whip him, because he was too really powerful as far as the people liked him and admired him and respected him. And so that instance with Obadiah Holmes and then Henry Dunster were the beginning of trying to make Massachusetts be more open. It wasn't easy, though, and it was not quick. In fact, you can go all the way until the 1680s. And you will see that basically you were Congregationalist and Congregationalist only in Massachusetts. It was so severe that back in England, men like John Owen and Thomas Goodwin, two English Congregationalists, wrote the leadership in Massachusetts and urged them to embrace liberty and freedom of liberty and religion and religious worship. I'm just paraphrasing what Owen and Goodwin said. They basically said it. We believe this is the faith. Let men practice and God will bring them to the true faith. But the leadership there would wait a long time before they would become tolerant. The difference was between the Puritans and the Baptists was very simply this. The Puritans indeed still wanted a state church based upon the medieval model of a corporate Christian state and church welded together that had authority over lives from a religious standpoint and civil and joined it all together. The Baptists wanted a voluntary individual conscience model when it came to the way someone practiced publicly their worship. That it was the person's conscience, it was the individual's freedom, choice to be able to participate in a Baptist service, Puritan service, or whatever it might be. And so the Massachusetts Bay Colony represented the one model, and the Rhode Island Colony represented the other model. And while we are thankful for Puritans, and we as Baptists have Puritan heritage, we agree with our Baptist forefathers that the church and the state are not to be welded as one, but instead there is to be separation. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for the courage and the strength of men like Obadiah Holmes and others, for their faith and for standing up in such pressure, standing up for what is true. We know as we studied this past Sunday that we can face persecution from the religious world and the secular world. I pray, Father, that you would always be with us and keep us, that we stand firm upon the faith. And we do so not being rude, but that we do so out of love, patience, but also steadfastness as well. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.